Chair and panel, Mr. O'Donnell and I represent six survivors of abuse by Peter Ball. They and others known to the police probably represent only a fraction of Ball's victims. The true number may never be known. But what is now very clear is that in the Church of England, Peter Ball found the perfect cover for his offending. If a charlatan with an insatiable appetite for abuse wanted to secure a continuous supply of vulnerable young victims, there was no better way of achieving this than by founding a religious order not subject to any external supervision and by making his victims' participation in the abuse a religious duty obligated by their oath of absolute obedience. Not for the first time, theology and religious ritual provided the ideal mask for abuse, with the evil of what Peter Ball did being compounded by his nauseating claim that the abuse was spiritually uplifting. Most of all, however, Peter Ball found in his fellow bishops in the Church of England the perfect accomplices, prepared to turn a blind eye to his abuse over many decades, to collude in the lie that the abuse of Neil Todd was an uncharacteristic aberration, to cast doubt on his guilt, to smear his victims, and to rehabilitate him. It is clear that for some years before the 1992 investigation, there were many in the Church of England who knew of or must have suspected Ball's offending and turned a blind eye to it, and later tried to evade their own culpability by claiming that Ball had never really offended at all. Eric Kemp, the Bishop of Chichester, was aware of serious concerns about Ball well before 1992, yet in 2006 he repeated the lie that Ball's resignation had been the work of mischief makers. However, of the senior leaders of the Church of England, in our view, none bears greater responsibility for this appalling saga than Lord Carey. We fear that when we hear from him this week, the usual litany of excuses will be trotted out. The past is apparently another country in which nobody really knew or understood that sex offending was wrong. We hope you will reject these self-serving excuses. Over the next few days, we will hear about the events of 1992 and 93, the investigation into the abuse of Neil Todd and the six letters received by Lambeth Palace alerting them to other evidence of abuse by Ball. We will debate the significance of those letters and the failure by Lambeth Palace to hand all of them over to the police. As an aside, I remind you that the only reason we have that debate is because the law in this country still allows institutions to sit on evidence of abuse and to decide not to pass it to the statutory authorities. We have no mandatory reporting law, and most of those letters were duly concealed. However, whatever your view of that, we know that on 5th of February 1993, in the full knowledge of that other evidence, Archbishop Carey wrote to the Chief Constable of Gloucestershire. In that letter, Archbishop Carey asserted about the Neil Todd allegation, and I quote, that if Ball is guilty of unprofessional behaviour, then it is quite unrepresentative of his style. Unrepresentative. This was Lord Carey's choice of word about the Todd allegation, when in fact he was well aware of other allegations. The Gibb report concludes that Lord Carey's language must give rise to the perception of deliberate concealment. We look forward to hearing from Lord Carey on this point. In the statements he has filed with this inquiry, Lord Carey ducks this issue, in our view. But to our clients, this language was deliberate misrepresentation of the known facts designed to protect a fellow bishop from justice. It is bad enough that evidence was withheld from the police. It was positively dishonest, in our view, to misinform the police that the allegation they were dealing with was unrepresentative of Ball's behaviour, when Lord Carey knew very well that there was evidence demonstrating the opposite. Chair, these issues matter a great deal to our clients. With the 1993 caution, Peter Ball escaped justice for 22 years. Neil Todd took his own life. Lord Carey, in our submission, needs to acknowledge his part in these outcomes. Despite his purported apology to the victims in his various statements, there is no real sign that he does so. Even in November 2014, when it must have been obvious to any reasonable observer that Ball was a charlatan and a fraud, Lord Carey wrote again to the police, claiming that Ball had served the church with great distinction, his words, and opposing any further criminal charges. In Lord Carey's behaviour throughout this saga, therefore, we see clericalism in its purest form, the loyalty of bishops and priests to each other, overriding basic norms of right and wrong. We note that Lord Carey's autobiography is entitled Know the Truth. When he comes before the inquiry tomorrow, we respectfully urge him to stop the excuses and the half-truths and to take this final opportunity to give a transparent account of his actions and to recognise how profoundly wrong they were. Those who have suffered so grievously from Peter Ball's behaviour deserve nothing less. Chair, the Church of England hierarchy bear much of the blame in this case, but there are others who feature in this story, from the police, the CPS, from Parliament, from the judiciary, and indeed from the monarchy, who also have much explaining to do. Because the Church of England is the established church, its leaders enjoy access to a nexus of establishment connections, patronage and privilege, and in evading justice for two decades, Peter Ball drew fully on these resources. One of his supporters, as we heard earlier, was Lord Lloyd of Berwick, the former Law Lord. Our clients have seen his extraordinary letter written in support of Ball on 2nd of February 1993. This, you will recall, was a letter to the Chief Constable. In his statement to this inquiry, Lord Lloyd implies that this was a character reference for sentencing purposes. However, this letter was written before the CPS had decided whether to charge Ball, and therefore, at the time that it was written, it cannot have been written for sentencing purposes. Despite Lord Lloyd's claim in the letter that he was not seeking to influence the police, it is difficult to see how the letter had any purpose other than to dissuade the Chief Constable from charging Peter Ball. Moreover, we submit that given his position as a senior member of the judiciary, writing on judicial letterhead, Lord Lloyd would have been well aware that writing to the police would inevitably be an act of influence. If there was no intention to influence, why write the letter at all? Chair, as you referred to earlier, the inquiry has also received a letter from His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. Chair, we wish to register our surprise and concern that the Prince has chosen to put his evidence before the inquiry in the form of a letter as opposed to a witness statement verified by a statement of truth in the normal way, and as survivors giving evidence to this inquiry have done. This will inevitably raise concerns that the letter may be less than entirely frank about his relationship with Peter Ball and that it contains matters to which he is reluctant to attach a formal statement of truth. In the interests of transparency, Chair, we therefore ask that the inquiry set out today all of the steps that it has taken to secure or attempt to secure a formal witness statement from the Prince. Turning to the substance of his letter, my clients fully accept that Prince Charles has many interactions with Church of England clergy. He cannot be responsible for the behaviour of all of them. However, he chose quite deliberately to maintain a relationship with Peter Ball after Ball's resignation as a bishop, and as we've heard, this included gifts of money and the provision of accommodation on the duchy estate. In justifying this relationship, Prince Charles claims that he was not aware at the time of the significance or impact of the caution that Peter Ball had accepted. He goes on to say that he was not aware until recently that a caution in fact carries an acceptance of guilt. With all due respect to His Royal Highness, my clients find this explanation frankly astonishing. The Prince of Wales has access to the best legal advice that money can buy. The Crown prosecutes people in this country every day on the principle that ignorance of the law is no defence. Yet seemingly this is the defence that the monarch-in-waiting seeks to rely on here. Later in his statement, Prince Charles tells us, and I quote, "I've always taken the view that the judicial process should take its course. I am then able to ground my opinions in facts tested by law rather than hearsay." But of course, Chair, there had been an outcome to the judicial process in 1993. Ball had admitted his guilt, a fact that had been heavily publicised in the national press. Yet Prince Charles apparently decided not to clarify the legal position. To my clients, this extraordinary lack of curiosity looks like willful blindness. The Prince claims that he was deceived about the true nature of Peter Ball's activities, but the fact is that he could easily have made efforts in 1993 to check the position, and he chose not to. Knowing that people can take his name in vain, and knowing that his support would have emboldened Ball in seeking a return to preaching and officiating, Prince Charles had a particular responsibility to check the position. He failed in that responsibility, and as such, he failed the victims of Peter Ball. Chair, we cannot allow a situation in this country where high-profile sex offenders can evade justice because of who they know. Over the past few years, we have all heard many allegations that the British establishment has protected prominent paedophiles from justice. No doubt some of those allegations will turn out to be overblown or without merit. However, in the case of Peter Ball, this, as it were, very English scandal, it is plain beyond doubt that senior figures in the establishment aided and cosseted a serial sex offender, and in many cases did so with knowledge. It falls to you, Chair and Panel, to hold them to account, and we urge you to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scorer.
Just before we hear from Mr. Giffen for the Archbishop's Council, if I could just respond to those the remarks that Mr. Scorer made about the inquiry and the letter from the Prince of Wales. The inquiry has made it clear on a number of occasions that what was required from the Prince of Wales was a witness statement bearing a statement of truth. The Prince of Wales legal team and the legal team for the inquiry entered into lengthy discussions as to the document to be produced. We received a final approved draft and asked that it be finalised with a statement of truth and signed. There can have been no doubt about what was required in the context of the inquiry's correspondence and discussions with the Prince's solicitors. For example, the inquiry provided the Prince of Wales solicitors with the inquiry witness statement template on the 12th of March 2018, the solicitor to the inquiry requesting that the document be signed and referring to the words statement on about five occasions. The words quoted in the letter that core participants will have seen from Harbottle and Lewis, solicitors for His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, were preceded by a specific request for a witness statement. Despite lengthy correspondence, including assertions from the solicitors representing His Royal Highness, that the inquiry's request for evidence were outside its powers, i.e. ultra vires, there was never any suggestion at any point that the statement would be provided by letter. When the signed document was received, it comprised the same text as the approved draft, but in the form of a letter for the first time. The last sentence of the letter does make clear that the material sets out within it is true. The inquiry considers that this substantively complies with the requirements of a statement of truth and that the letter received contains all the information and evidence which the inquiry needs. Nevertheless, the form in which it was presented was not what had been requested, and since this matter has been raised following Mr. Scorer's query last week, His Royal Highness's solicitors have not undertaken to provide the Prince's evidence in witness statement format. The inquiry's process for obtaining this evidence involved issuing first a request under Rule 9 of the inquiry's rules and subsequently notices under Section 21 of the Inquiry's Act, requiring the Prince to produce the evidence required. Exception was made by His Royal Highness's solicitors to both types of request, and written submissions were made to the inquiry raising various points. These included submissions that the inquiry had no power to require the Prince to make a statement in the light of the provisions of Section 50 of the Inquiries Act 2005, that the inquiry's requests were for his personal data, that they were asking for matters which were intensely private and confidential, and thus subject to Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, and that the information required was neither necessary nor proportionate, and that the inquiry's handling of its request was unfair, and that the inquiry, in effect, had no power to compel him to produce a statement. The inquiry did adjust its requests in some respects as a result, but did not resolve from its core demand of the need to obtain this evidence or accept the contention that His Royal Highness should be treated in a way that was different from anyone else. After lengthy and extensive correspondence and some discussions about this, agreement was reached on a statement that His Royal Highness would produce on a voluntary basis. As a consequence, the Section 21 notices were revoked because the inquiry had obtained the evidence it needed and they were not necessary. The draft document disclosed to core participants on the 9th of July and the signed letter dated the 16th of July both covered all of the topics that the inquiry wished to see addressed by this witness. I hope that has clarified for Mr. Scorer and for others the process which was undertaken. Thank you.